The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets have a squirrely week. Tech stocks help save the markets, and trade tensions are escalating. And our guest today, Danielle DiMartino Booth. All this and much more on episode number 612 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And hello and welcome. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I hope everybody's doing well. Hope you had a great week, profitable week. I'm going to be attending friend's wedding this weekend, and that means we're gonna have a little bit of a shorter show this week, but we have a great guest and a few things to cover before we get there, though, because there's some interesting things that have developed. A couple things I just want to kind of throw at you and let you know what's going on. We've had these webinars we just started this week on Friday, or last week Friday. We had a webinar which looked at some trading opportunities, looking at markets structure and technical indicators. Particularly, we looked at volume and price, and we did that. I started with a new webinar software company, and they have some great features, but I'm not exactly sure of the quality. So we're going to see if we're going to stay with them or move with someone else. But here's the point. The point is that each and every Friday, 9 a.m., we're going to be doing a webinar, and I've got a discussion that's going to bring in things like technical analysis of stocks that you're interested in, some things that are moving in the morning, kind of a pre-market rundown. So if you want to get involved in that, make sure to stay tuned to my Twitter feed. That's at Andrew Horowitz, and you'll get all the information you need there. And then also get on the mailing list. We'll send you some things there as well. We'll make sure to put all that information out there. So as we get this more developed, we'll probably have it live on YouTube at the same time. So you could do that in the mornings, and we'll make sure that you're available to see what's going on there. But if you are on the mailing list for The Disciplined Investor, we'll mail out a few things to you as well. So you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and a little pop-up screen that comes up, and you'll be able to sign up right there. So Friday mornings at 9 a.m. sharp, about a half hour will be the discussion, and talk about a lot of different things related to the market, what's going on, not only pre-market, but for the week, and you know, go back and forth and talk about it. Should be fun, should be interesting, should be educational. We're going to be also utilizing primarily the trigger charts indicators that we developed that are available on the TradeStation network and the platform exclusively for TradeStation. So that should be fun. I'm going to also mention to you that Investology, I had mentioned this before, that during the month of May, any new accounts that are funded through the Investology platform, which is our robo-esque type of platform where we blend the best of robo-advising from a technology standpoint, and then we manage the money, and we manage your assets and your account for you, utilizing institutional-based, for the most part, mutual funds and ETFs, and you get what we do for our global allocations to a degree in terms of the way that we allocate our philosophy on the markets, but also you're involved in the process of setting up the account and the model portfolio. So you can go to investology.com and check it out. $10,000 minimum. That's all it is. All right. What else did I want to talk about here? Let's see. Next week we have coming up John Markman on the show, and he's always good to have on. We haven't talked to him in a while, so that should be very interesting. John is an old pro when it comes to markets. He's seen it all, written about it all, several books, newsletters, but just a real brilliant guy overall. So we're going to have him on the show next week. And then we're going to have a gent from S&P. We're going to talk about a wrap-up of the earnings season. That's the following week. So lots going on, lots to do. Make sure to tell your friends, your family, people you don't know, retweet, put it out there, put it on Facebook. Tell them about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'd appreciate it, so that we can get this thing continuing to be as popular as it is. So a couple things I want to just go over before we get to our guest, and just kind of focus in on a few things that I thought were really interesting last week. You know, one of the things that really is starting to stand out to me is the lack of any kind of fundamental underpinnings for certain stocks in the markets, particularly those stocks that have had these incredible runs. Their valuations have gotten well above them where they should be. And now looking like, you know, is there going to be a point that reality sets in and all of a sudden everybody says, you know what? Maybe they're not worth as much as we thought they were. For example, we look at what happened with Lyft. We look at what happened with Uber. Two interesting IPOs in the same business, of course, but neither of them are making any money. But yet everybody was clamoring to get into these IPOs. Now, we know how poorly the Uber IPO did, went down immediately when it became public. Lyft, on the other hand, people were really excited about. They really, you know, ramped it higher and then took it down, realizing, whoa, what am I doing here? Wait a minute. Why am I buying a stock that doesn't look like it's ever going to be able to produce a profit? And there's a lot of reasons why people buy stocks. There's traders that are just looking to buy it and run with it, short it, take it down, whatever it is. There's others that are looking for a good company to buy into and be a part of. In other words, an owner, essentially, of a company. And you don't do that with companies that aren't making money and that don't have a prospect of really turning a profit anytime in the near future. And we saw that some other IPOs came out, like Pinterest, did really well. Their first earnings came out and it was abysmal. Pinterest came out Thursday night with their earnings numbers and it was just awful. Stock was down probably right close to its IPO price when it came out, the day it came out, and started to move back up a little bit. But nonetheless, still, I think there's people are getting a little wise to the idea that maybe there is more to this than just the price movement. And what I mean by that is that it's high time that we have some potential for earnings for some of these companies. Now, for example, we also look at like what's going on with Tesla. Tesla went to a multi-year, I think a two-year low on Friday after CEO Elon Musk said, you know what, we're going to do some real cost cutting here because unfortunately, the most recent capital raise that they had is only going to give them about 10 months to break even at its current burn rate. And investors are like, wait. You know, I thought we were being bought out some time ago and things were looking really good. You're supposed to be profitable and then you weren't. And you're supposed to have this production, but you're being a little weird in your conference calls and explaining how this is going to be. You weren't going to do a capital raise and then you're doing a capital raise. And now here we are with all of a sudden this major hardcore cost cutting, which means firings, which means all sorts of ways to try their best to bring down expenses because they realize that they're in big trouble here. And this is nothing that is a realization for anyone that's listened to the show for a long time. You know that I've said that Tesla is really, I love the car, but you can love the car, you can love the product, but not love the company. And I also said, and I suggested that maybe it's time to get another CEO in there that can really understand how to run a business and keep Elon Musk on as the visionary, the futurist, the engineer, if you will. The problem is that he doesn't seem to be able to make both things work at once. So something's got to give here. My point is that we're at a point and I think a juncture in the markets that a lot of the upside that we recently saw in the face of all the other items that we know of a slowing economic backdrop, of a global economy that's looking awful and worse almost every day, that was propped up primarily by the gestures and the hope that the Fed would continue to lower rates and then valuations being reevaluated based on a lower interest rate is something that maybe markets are starting to get a handle on that. Maybe we've overdone it here. It just seems to me that it would be very hard to understand how if the underlying fundamentals don't pick up both on earnings and economics, how we see new highs right away. And with the specter of another $300 plus billion of tariffs being put on, things slow down and get even more squirrely, which is a great segue to talk about the Fed, talk about what they're doing with our next guest. So why don't we get right into that right now? And our guest today is Danielle DiMartino Booth from Quill Intelligence. And we've had Danielle on several times before. She's a Fed insider. Don't tell anybody. And she's going to give us some information. Hopefully, I have a lot of questions about the Fed, Danielle.
I've got a lot of answers for you, but you might not like all of them.
Probably not. I mean, this, you know, it's amazing because the last time you were on was in November. And at that time, the Fed was on autopilot. And the markets were getting a little squirrely. And then December came and all of a sudden, poof, things changed. So kind of give me just a quick rundown on your thoughts on this as it's being said in the media, the pivot.
So I have I've gotten a fair bit of pushback because I think that the world is misleadingly too stock market centric. I don't think Jay Powell was frightened into his shell by the stock market. He was always pretty upfront about that. But on Halloween, General Electric's bonds were downgraded and by Moody's. And within 14 days, the junk bond market had shut down. Of course, by Halloween, things were very hairy in the stock market. But anyways, 14 days after Halloween, the junk bond issuance market went into a deep freeze that it didn't come out of for a record 41 days. So I've been trying to explain to people that it's much more important that credit volatility remain contained because it's a much bigger beast than stock market volatility. Much, much bigger. There's a lot more debt in the world than there is equity because debt has been the primary instrument that central bankers worldwide have used to generate growth in this post-quantitative easing era. If you want to think about global QE is equivalent more or less to U.S. debt. I know they're apples and oranges, but you just say somewhere in the $22 trillion neighborhood. But if you have a freezing up of the debt markets, the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlement, they all start paying attention when they see credit spreads gap out, volatility go up, and outflows from very illiquid vehicles begin in earnest, mainly because there's nothing that any central bank can do to address an illiquidity problem of the magnitude that would be unleashed if this massive credit leverage bubble was to burst.
So this is probably why a lot of people talk about how the bond market is quote unquote smarter than the stock market because a lot more sensitivity to a variety of issues and on the magnitude of it. But if Powell wasn't frightened into his shell in, due to the stock market, what was happening there, you're saying that maybe there was obviously some liquidity concerns that got to them and they kind of twisted around pretty good and started to all of a sudden say, you know, well, we're not going to tighten as much, et cetera. But at the same time, if we fast forward to where we are today, things got pretty much alleviated relatively quickly, right? We saw that giant V from the stock market. We saw credit spreads get much better to where they were. We see all-time highs on some actual bond funds these days, you know, if you consider total return. And really, I mean, by all standards, we're back to everything is fine in the credit markets.
We are, because you have to remember there is a symbiosis. There's a very important symbiosis between the credit market and the stock market. If you're Joe Q, CFO at a great big company, and your debt is downgraded, and the big rating agencies slap you on the wrist and tell you to take care of your balance sheet, what is the one thing, Andrew, that you're going to have to stop doing that the stock market loves?
Yeah, issuing debt.
No, share buyback.
Well, issuing debt to get share buybacks.
That's a little bit of a red herring because the bulk of buybacks have been financed with free cash flow that lots of companies have had. They've had a lot of cash, but it's more so that if you are paying attention to your balance sheet over that of your shareholders, you necessarily have to battening down the hatches is equivalent to stopping share buybacks. And what you get then is you get an adverse feedback loop. You start off an invirtuous cycle. It's not pretty, because tending to the balance sheet necessarily means that you have to abandon your shareholders with those buybacks that they love so much, such that bond market upheaval feeds its way into the stock market, and it becomes this downward spiral that nobody wants to see, especially Jay Powell.
You know, it's interesting because that leads us right into the discussion of buybacks, because buybacks, I saw some fascinating statistics recently that showed who were the buyers of stocks in the markets. In other words, who is buying stocks? And it looked like over the last 10 years, institutions have been dropping their buying, and you see that retail's really been net outflow of stocks for a while. And it's really been the companies, the corporations who have been buying. And what does that say about our market environment? Does it say anything?
Well, it says our market environment is very much a mirage, and that Main Street, when they see that the Dow Jones Industrials has gone down 600 points or it's gone up 400 points, whatever they may see, your average Joe is going to think that investors are more bullish on stocks. That's simply not true, because the fund flows and the origins of the fund flows simply don't lie. And all you've got is companies saying, we're still in a cheap money environment. We don't know what it looks like in a post cheap money environment. It doesn't look like the Fed's going to be able to even normalize interest rates. So we're still not going to consider capital expenditures to the extent that we would if we knew that the Fed was at a point where they were saying, all clear, you know what, we've got neutral interest rates, we can see over the horizon, and we see growth in front of us. They can't. The Fed can't see that. The Fed could not normalize interest rates. So again, if you're the executives of a company, you're going to say, you know what, I'm just going to sit on my hands and continue to maximize shareholder value, because it's one of the things that I'm paid to do. And by the way, every time I reduce the number of shares outstanding, I increase my earnings per share on which my bonus pool is based.
You know, let's get to the straight and skinny here on this whole the desire and need to increase shareholder value. That is a great line to say, prop up my stock. Isn't it the same thing?
It is one and the same, but you have to bear in mind that there are shareholders out there. Are they the same shareholder that your and my grandfather's shareholders were? No. Are we talking about mutual funds or even active investors? No, we're not. We're talking about index funds. So what's perverse about this whole thing is that you are maximizing shareholder value, but they're kind of anonymous shareholders. And this is something that John Bogle of Vanguard started being very outspoken about before he died a few months ago, saying, I don't know what the future of the stock market is going to bring if the main investors are agnostic and passive in nature. And as we know, we're headed towards, you know, potentially 50% of the market being exchange-traded funds, index funds here over the course of the next few years. That is not a healthy development, but it does help explain why when we get upheavals in the market, there is so much immediate, instantaneous volatility because the machines take over.
Yeah. It's interesting. Now, I want to just go back up something. So we talked about you were in on the show in November. We talked about some of the things that happened in Halloween and the credit market seizing up. And then somewhere in December, all hell broke loose. And then right at the end of December into the new year, right at the beginning of the year, all of a sudden this pivot, this, hey, you know what? We're not going to be on autopilot anymore. We're not going to be increasing interest rates on a regular basis. And we're going to really just look at the data. We're going to look at, you know, what does it say to us? You know, the dot plot and the data points, and we're going to all this. Now, right about then, give or take about January, as things started to do a V reversal, I wrote you an email. Remember, I said, listen, tell me something. Tell me about Jay Powell and tell me about the Fed members, what they're allowed to own in their portfolios on a personal basis, because I was kind of curious about this. This kind of struck a chord. And you sent me back what the official writings are and the edicts of what they can own and what they can't. And essentially, if I may paraphrase for a second, then let you take over, it basically says something like this. They are not, well, what they're not allowed to own. They're not allowed to own any direct investments in a bank or financial institution, inclusive of the stock, the bonds, anything related to that, right? But other than that, it's pretty much they can do whatever they want.
Yes. And in fact, this became something of a sticky, thorny issue during the crisis years because we were prompted to help companies such as General Motors, Acceptance Corporation, GMAC back in the day, the financing arm of Caterpillar. And because some of these larger industrials had such huge financial footprints, there was kind of this gray area where, the Fed's getting involved in companies that it shouldn't be involved in. But the bottom line is, if we in any way, shape, or form are providing, if the Fed is in any way, shape, or form providing liquidity and or regulating an entity, it is not allowed to own them directly. It is allowed to own passive investing. In other words, it could own the S&P 500 index fund that might have a large portion of its holding in JP Morgan Chase. But that is a blind way of being exposed, so therefore there's no conflict to be perceived. But the irony when you asked me this question was, oh my gosh, the Fed can't fight itself. So it should just be long stocks all day long.
Right. So no, the thing is also that I looked up what was the latest disclosure we saw from Jay Powell. I looked at him in particular. And at the time when he gave this disclosure back in, I think, 2017, I believe it was, maybe it was start of 18, he was worth about $120 million. And I started to think about this. You know, I looked at the holdings and there was a lot of S&P related mutual funds and there was a lot of broad market mutual funds, a lot of bond mutual funds. And I thought to myself in December, I wonder if he looked down at his statement and just playing this out for a second, let's pretend it was still worth $120 million right before. And now all of a sudden it's down 15% because there was a large holdings in many of these equity positions. And now he lost $15 million back in December. You don't think that that had an impact on his decision?
Well, look.
He's human. He's human.
No. And we're all human. And he must have thought to himself, I can afford this. But good God, what's happening in middle America with Joe Q's 401k? The ability to lose $15 million is a blessing.
Yeah, let's thank you. Thank God I could lose $15 million and not worry about it, right?
Exactly. But he has to have been thinking, and again, the damage done to mom and pop who own bond mutual funds and bond market ETFs was going to be bloodier than that of the same couple that might have owned equity mutual funds, because there was less liquidity in that part of the market. And mom and pop are thinking, we own bonds because we're getting older and therefore we should be in safer investments. So the Fed, even Janet Yellen years ago, spoke up and said, gee, the whole idea of this high yield ETF is kind of bad from the get-go. Well, no kidding. I mean, thank you, Captain Obvious. Yeah. But it's never been tested. And what we saw in December was the beginning of what that test looked like with withdrawals, with redemptions, and with traders saying, you know what, I could not trade this bond. It was trading by appointment only. And you're talking about some pretty deep losses that would have taken a lot of retirees and public pensions completely by surprise.
And was that all predicated on the fact that it was simply a autopilot that they were on, that they were reducing liquidity on the QE, they were pulling back a little bit? I mean, because if you think about it, they really didn't do a lot of differential. And let me state one other obvious point here, which a lot of people seem to miss. Since that pivot, nothing has changed. The rates are the same as they were. The QE that they were doing is exactly the same as it was, right? So there's nothing changed since December in a Fed actual policy. It was just the commentary about the future.
That's exactly right. And it was the commentary about the future. I know you're going to be like, we're going to end our conversation. You're going to beat your head up against a wall and you're going to be like, man, she was a broken record. But the commentary, when he was on stage and he said that he would consider using all of the tools in the Fed's toolbox, including quantitative easing. We are a generation of spoiled investors. I don't care how nicely you want to couch that. But investors immediately lobbed on to, oh, there's QE coming. There's liquidity coming. So therefore, you know, there shouldn't be mass upheaval in the bond markets, and trading opened back up. New issuance took back off. And again, CFOs were free to do share buybacks, which were at an all-time record in the first quarter. And meanwhile, back at the ranch in Beijing, the People's Bank of China was shoving nearly $900 billion worth of stimulus out the door in the first 3 months of the year. So look, you throw over $1 trillion of stimulus at a global economy, you're going to get that V-shaped recovery in risky asset prices, because asset markets live and die on liquidity, which is why you cannot have the People's Bank of China say, we don't want to put as much stimulus into the market starting in the second quarter. Guess what's happened to the Chinese market since then? It's tanked.
So here, but here's the thing. I mean, and I'm starting to bang my head a little bit. It's getting a little bit of a red mark already, but now the Fed says, well, we're going to, you know, watch the data. And we know their official mandate is inflation, this arbitrary 2% number that somebody picked out of a hat some time ago. And they keep on repeating it until we all believe that, yeah, that's the right amount of interest of inflation. That 2% inflation rate, that's the right amount. I mean, it's arbitrary, but it is. And then we see our employment numbers. You know, the Fed came out with like, oh, you know, we're concerned about the future. We're going to wait to see things. We have better employment numbers, 3.6% unemployment rate. We're seeing great numbers on the employment numbers and the payroll additions being added. The initial claims are still in the 200,000 range, low 200,000 range, lowest we've seen in 50 years. Inflation, which I got to tell you, which we all know there is inflation, but somehow magically, miraculously, even with the tariffs, even with all of this, there's no inflation, which is just a modern day miracle.
And it's a bunch of hooey, but yes.
What's that?
I said it's a bunch of hooey.
Yeah, well, it's a bunch of hooey, but somehow there's somebody, you know what they say, figures never lie, but liars always figure. You know, there's something going on with the statistics that's a little bit off. But nonetheless, so now the Fed says we're going to be data dependent. And meanwhile, just backing up one other point, everybody's thinking that there's going to be, in the last rate cut announcement, everybody's like, there's going to be a rate cut. I'm thinking, who's thinking there's going to be a rate cut? But that's what the markets were betting on, right? They were thinking it was going to be a rate cut. He turns a little bit more hawkish. Markets come back, makes a comment about inflation being transitory. Like, you know, this is the golden ring that they'll never get. They can never seemingly get this level of inflation. If they do, by the way, it will not be because of their efforts. Mark my words. It will be just something else that happened in the economy. Where do they go from here with everything being equal, with valuations at all-time highs or thereabouts, close to, on the markets, and bond markets in good shape again, but yet we're back to the same economic situation that we saw, that things were heating up dramatically? Where do they go now?
You know, it's really hard to say, because there are cross currents in the data, and yet you've got stocks as close as they are to all-time highs. They're not in a good place. Look, every time we've had an unemployment rate that's been at this low of a level, call it somewhere around 3.6%, 12 months out, it's not pretty. Because once you stretch that rubber band too far, it's going to snap back. And, you know, the undercurrents, you know, 9 straight months of year over year, not month over month, 9 straight months of year over year increases in layoffs. That is not an aberration. It is not something that you can ignore. It's not even a trend. It's a fact. And
wait, explain this to me. I'm lost. 9 years.
Not 9 straight months.
Years of months. Wait. Years of months.
You say we're layoffs over the last 12 months are up over the prior 12 months.
They are? How is that if we have unemployment numbers that keep it coming in so good?
It's Challenger, Gray, and Christmas data. It's leading indicator.
Right, it's always been
a leading indicator.
Gotcha.
We've had retail Armageddon for however long we have. That's an old story. It's an old story that continues, however, to continue. So it's still the leading sector of layoffs. But right behind it in 2019, you've got a new second and third co-star called the industrial sector and the automobile industry. These are leading cyclical sectors that tell you that the decline in new orders in the most recent ISM report was a shot across the bow saying, you know what? We had all that panic-induced buying ahead of the tariffs that never were. And that led to a surge in the manufacturing sector as companies stockpiled more than they needed. But now that's wearing off. So we're seeing trucking rates and then the cost of big rigs. We're seeing them come back as quickly as they went up and made 2018 appear to be such a robust economy. And that is the conundrum for the Fed, because the unemployment rate is the most lagging of all economic indicators.
But then add to that, by the way, that the latest GDP report, which came in very hot, approximately from everything I can see, about 0.7% of that was an inventory increase that was, or inventories that increased so dramatically. I was off a quarter. I thought we were going to start to see a significant slowdown in economic activity first quarter this year, with the first quarter, not the first quarter, but the first quarter's numbers. Which is about now. And I'm pretty surprised we still didn't see that much of a drop. I mean, there are definite signs that there are problems due to the whole pull forward and the whole front loading of, you know, the tariffs. It just seems to me it's, you know, even if we just popped them 25%, you know, the supposedly it's only going to increase pricing by like 1%. Some of these numbers is bizarre to me. They just don't make sense.
Well, they don't make sense. And the problem is that it doesn't matter if there's only a slight economic impact. The longer that this uncertainty hangs over the market, right? I mean, the first tweet that was sent out about potential tariffs was like in April of 2018. We've been in this for a very long time, which is why markets are so sensitive to any new news. But it also tells you that markets are priced to perfection. And there is nothing that ever follows that is good 12 months out when the unemployment rate is near a record low, when markets are stretched precariously thin and based on buybacks only, and when everything is priced to perfection that you can possibly name. That means that nothing can go wrong, even as we know that the underlying economy has started to slow.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I think one thing that people should do is take a look at the stock chart of U.S. Steel, symbol X, and take a look at that. That was one of the first things that was tariffed, you know, back when, and it was going to be good for our steel companies. That has gone from $45 down to $15.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Tariffs are working, and not to mention the fact, I just got to get your 2 cents on this real quickly. The idea of tariffs. I've been screaming about this, ranting about this, and going a little bit like off the rails on the idea, because I'm so sick of hearing that tariffs are paid by the Chinese in this tariff war. And it's a trade war. It is a trade war. It's not a skirmish. It's not a kerfuffle. It's not a disagreement. It's a trade war, right? Do you agree with that?
Oh, I think we're in the middle of a huge trade war.
Right. Secondly, the idea that the Chinese are paying the tariffs on the goods. Thoughts?
Look, let me put it this way. Technically speaking, yes. But do we all pay a huge price because we all get taxed? Yes, we do. Is this the margin squeeze of all time? Yes, it is. Yeah. Do American companies lose business? Yes, they do. Do prices for American households increase? Yes, they do. There are no winners.
Yeah, nothing. No winners here. All right, so the last thing here is I just want to discuss this one thing and appreciate all your insights on the Fed. Again, it's Quill. Why don't you tell us about Quill. Tell us about what you do there.
So Quill Intelligence was founded. We started publishing the Daily Feather Memorial Day. The day after Memorial Day marks our one-year anniversary. We're so pleased to be here. We have a cult following that we're extremely proud of. And this follows on the heels of a weekly publication that started in June of 2015, right after I followed Richard Fisher out the doors of the Federal Reserve and into retirement back into the private sector. So follow me at @DMartinoBooth, go to the website, quillintelligence.com, see what we're all about. We only care about where the economy is headed. We only care about where we are in the cycle. We don't, we do not seasonally adjust our thinking, and it is always entertaining and fun.
Seasonally adjust thinking. I like that.
Nope, we don't. Sorry. Life's too short.
Last question I have for you. This latest round of appointments that we saw from President Trump for the Fed, Stephen Moore, what do you make of these? I'm not going to pepper it. What are your thoughts on the latest round of appointments for the Fed?
Look, I don't take any issue with trying to bring people into the Fed who are not PhDs in economics, who are not driven by their models, who have had real world experience, who have different opinions and viewpoints. I think that the intellectual diversity issue on the Federal Open Market Committee is one of the greatest challenges. They're stuck, they're mired in one of the chapters of Fed Up called Group Stink. However, if you bring in people who are blatantly political operatives, then they're going to fail from the get-go. They're never going to be able to be to truly participate and be taken seriously as a peer on the Federal Open Market Committee if it looks just like the president wants to have a hot phone in the middle of the night that he can pick up and call and say, "Do my bidding." And by the way, two people out of 17 can't do anybody's bidding. It's a majority rule type of situation on the Federal Open Market Committee. I will say that people who have been advocating for sound money, such as Judy Shelton, I would certainly back her. Her name is being bandied about. She's great. But the problem is she's an advocate for sound money. And sound money, sound money disciplined approach types, they don't walk into office first day on the FOMC and say, "Screw it, let's take interest rates to zero and launch quantitative easing." That is the absolute opposite of what a disciplined approach to monetary policy dictates. So at this point, I don't know who he can find, because you won't have an operative taken seriously and a sound money person won't do his bidding.
Interesting. Well, a lot more interesting things to see in the future. We'll see how this all plays out. Until the next time, Danielle DiMartino Booth will put all the information on how to get in touch with you, your Twitter, your websites, all that good stuff on the show notes for episode number 612 of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. See you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good stuff from Danielle DiMartino Booth. Always insightful, interesting, and giving us a great perspective on really what's going on, what's going down, what's really happening in the minds of these Fed officials, which the markets put such an importance on. I've been doing this for 30 years, give or take a couple of days, and I got to tell you something. Over the last several years, the importance of the Fed, it's always been important, of course, interest rates and the economic power they have to change things, always important. But it's become so overwhelmingly important to investors as they're watching the daily moves. It wasn't where we had constant conversations and lectures and luncheons and dinners and speeches by Fed officials back when. It's only been really since, I would say, the last 10 years or so that they feel compelled to come out there and strut their stuff and flap their feathers and tell us, what they think and how they think it's going to go and try to manipulate and maneuver the economy and the markets at the same time in a place that they believe it should be, because they've figured out, at least from their perspective, that the wealth effect is all important in really generating an economic expansion and continuing that expansion. Of course it is. Because we have more invested in the markets individually through 401ks than we did 30 years ago. By a long shot. Back then, 30, 40, 50 years ago, what happened was you'd work for a company. Don't get excited and say, what are you talking about here? Here's what happened. You worked for a company, and that company guaranteed your retirement. They guaranteed that once you retire at the age of, let's say, 65, that you're going to get a salary of 2/3 of your current highest 10 years or, income that you've had for the rest of your life, or whatever whatever the formula was. But it was close to something like that. So you could pretty much take it to the bank that, once you retire, you're going to continue getting a salary. And then it shifted dramatically over the years where your retirement is your responsibility. And by doing so, now there's more money involved in markets than ever before, because pension plans, the defined pension plans of years ago, were really invested primarily in safe interest-bearing investments, treasuries, maybe corporate bonds, and maybe a peppering of stocks in there. It wasn't like now where your retirement plan is at least probably 50 or 60% in equities. So the importance of markets staying up have really been that much more integral in the overall economic component, because no longer are companies paying for your benefits. Once you're gone, you're gone. They have no more requirement to pay you anything. And of course, there are some municipalities and government positions and other companies that, yes, still do pay a defined benefit plan. But generally speaking, most companies figured out it's a lot less cost and a lot more profitable overall to have a 401k or a defined contribution plan where they participate to a degree and you participate to a greater degree. So yes, the wealth effect is very important for the economy. But when does it end? You know, when do we have a situation where the economics that we're seeing are enough? And that's kind of where the Fed comes in, because right now they believe that they are all powerful, all being and all knowing at the same time. And you know what? If anybody's ever looked carefully, and if you take a look, their economic outlooks really are not so good. In fact, they're pretty bad. But we still rely on them, and that's what we have to do. So I encourage you to, once again, get on the mailing list for Danielle and check out what she has to say on a regular basis. Get her book, Fed Up. That's a great read. Give you a great insight into what's going on. And realize that, you know, here is where we are today with the Fed. That's the cards we're dealt. That's what we have to deal with. And okay, that's fine. But realize that at the same time, they really have no greater insight than any of the economists out there, or maybe even what you're looking at with yours, with what you're seeing. We're going to wrap it up there before I get into a further rant, outrage, and hysteria about the Fed. But we'll be back next week with John Markman. I hope you join us. And don't forget about those 9 a.m. market rundowns that we're going to do, the pre-market rundowns that we'll do. Just get on the mailing list and we'll make sure you get them. Plus, we'll have all that information on Twitter, as I mentioned. Until next week, I want to thank you for joining me. I'll see you again. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.